Hi, and on the Philosopher's Zone today, spooky action at a distance.
I think a couple of sort of core things. The first is the question of scientific observation. The idea that reality exists out there for us to see, and Niels Bohr's insight that reality changes precisely when we're looking at it. And this presumption that until we look, the world is in some sense only probabilistic, which its immediate application to things like morality or sort of Kantian foundationalism is a real crisis. The world is only probabilistic. I don't feel probabilistic.
Neither do I. Well, not at this moment anyway. But quantum mechanics sets up a strange state of physical affairs, like entanglement, where two seemingly distant particles conduct a causal relationship. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. He didn't like it much, because it confounds the idea that things need to be in proximity for one to affect the other. So, all very well in complex physics, and that's where it should stay. Or should it? A curious event that's been held in Australia for the past few years has tried to broaden the quantum conversation. The Q Symposium says it wants physicists and philosophers to explore the outcomes of a quantum age way beyond physics. Ambitious? Yep. But is it on the right track? Jerris Grove of the University of Hawaii gave the keynote this year, and he has no doubts about the wider implications of spooky action. Jerris Grove, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you.
The quantum conversation, what does that mean? What does it mean to have a conversation with the model of quantum or the idea of quantum in it?
It's a great question. It's actually, it was the question of the first Q event. So we're now on our third event. And the Q one was a kind of proof of concept, right? And the initial question was, how have we had this sort of shattering of our worldview? The classical world doesn't work the way that we thought it worked. Space and time don't work the way that we thought that they worked. And then kind of, in some sense, had no effect, right? So, you know, there's some trickling in philosophy and, you know, you can see it in art and film, but we still basically act like we live in a classical world. And so we wanted to think about that lag. Why wasn't this revolution as revolutionary? And then related to that, why did the revolution, in some sense, affect us in the worst possible way? We didn't get the great philosophical or ethical quantum revolution. We got the nuclear revolution. And that brought us to this concern and also the interest in Sydney, which is that the quantum computer could be another one of these real scale breaks where science changes the condition of possibility of politics and international politics.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about international politics as the end part of this, but just sure. Get our definitions right here. When we say the revolution, what do we mean? We mean what was brought up in the quantum conceptualization as opposed to the classical Newtonian
sure.
view of the world, yeah?
I think a couple of sort of core things. The first is the question of scientific observation, the idea that reality exists out there for us to see, and Niels Bohr's insight that actually reality changes exactly precisely when we're looking at it. And this presumption that until we look, the world is in some sense only probabilistic, which, you know, in its immediate sort of application to things like morality or sort of Kantian foundationalism is a real crisis. The world is only probabilistic. I don't feel probabilistic. The second was the idea of non-locality. So similarly, this observation phenomena, what it was fixing, was something that actually wasn't there, right? That something like the electron wasn't a place in space-time, it was an average distribution of probability in space-time. So that maybe an electron wasn't a thing, a real object, but it constituted reality. And I think that's a hard thing for humans to think about, that the majority of what we consider hard matter is quite literally not there.
Until a lot of space involved.
A lot of space, not a lot of, you know, I mean, it took building the enormous CERN to even figure out what was giving it mass, right? So until we had the Higgs boson, it kind of seemed like it was all air, at least as far as we could describe. So I think it was a crisis in the predictability of reality.
So when you say the revolution hasn't taken hold in the way it probably should have or ought to have, it sort of has in the world of physics. What you're doing is extracting it as a model for the other worlds,
right,
as in culture, society, art, and politics.
Right. I'm a social scientist by training, and we still, and particularly in international politics, we tend to describe the world as a set of billiard balls where there are set relations, and when they hit into each other, there's a set reaction. And so the idea that physics had blown apart the model of causality, right? That the difference between cause and effect was actually quite indeterminate. And yet, most social scientists were still using a kind of 17th century version of physics in which we could really understand the sort of efficient model of causality. So part of what we're going to do is to update that. Like, how should we think differently if we're going to describe systems?
That's very interesting, because what you're saying is it's grounded in one particular view of reality, in that that causal thing that quantum physics is showing is different from the causal thing that physics that came before it showed. But why can't that be a different thing from what the sociologist or the philosopher or the artist may be wanting to see?
Is it physics all the way down?
Yeah.
I don't think so. But what I do think is that it was physics all the way down for those thinkers, right? So, you know, Descartes forward, certainly Kant, right, has this sort of rationalistic view of how reality works, which then they smuggle back into philosophy. So at the very least, we have to start over a little bit and ask the question, how much are our philosophical concepts indebted to a kind of cheat, right? Not having actually derived, you know? So like the beginning of the Critique of Pure Reason, right? We're introduced to these a priori schema, space and time. There's no basis for them. They're by definition a priori. It's just that the transcendental argument doesn't work if there's not space to distribute things in our awareness and time to sequence them. What if that doesn't exist? And I think for me, someone who studies things like terrorism and Donald Trump and these sort of overly emotional, sort of affective phenomena, those don't actually accord to space and time very well. And so we needed a way to not drag quantum into philosophy, but have our own quantum revolution in philosophy and social theory.
Okay, so we see the usefulness of that. One of the terms you've got onto for this time round is entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
What is, just let's start from the beginning, what is entanglement in a physical sense?
In physics, it's, you know, Bohr proposed that there was the possibility that once two particles were entangled in what we think of as classical space-time, you could spread them out, and there would be no observable or discernible relationship between the two. But tapping on one, in a very technical sense, would cause tapping on the other, right? That there was this kind of continued causal relationship without explicit spatial relationship. Einstein thought this was ridiculous.
Right? Because you can't do it at a distance, right?
Yeah, but they do. Yeah. But Einstein said it was spooky action at a distance. He and Podolsky and Rosen basically made fun of it and said, it's not that it's happening by magic. It's that we just haven't figured out how to measure what that relationship is yet. But then John Bell did this fascinating research where he could show that there really was observable interference, right? Even though the two objects were quite far apart. Again, this is one of those sort of inherited understandings of both causality and space and time. We think that you can't affect something without there being a measurable force between it.
Mm. Now, I don't want to derail this as a model, because I know that you've got interesting things to say about it in the larger realm, but I do know that there are physicists who think that, in fact, there's a mistake being made, that what we think is causality is actually correlation, that one does it at the same time as the other, because right. They just happen to correlate, not one affecting the other in
right.
some way.
Yeah, Chris Fuchs has actually made an incredible and powerful argument to this effect, what he calls cubism, or Quantian Bayesianism.
He's been on the show, actually.
Cubism is a much better term for it. I can barely understand and explain Bayesianism. But his version, I think, is quite interesting. It's that the sort of quantum phenomena that we see, this idea that there's a sort of wave-particle duality, or these two particles that are separated, that's actually just the effect of our measurement of them, not in the sense of ontologically the measurement, but epistemologically, right? So they appear indeterminate or entangled because we haven't looked at them yet. And because they have multiple different characteristics, the sort of what he calls the betting is what changes it, sort of sets or breaks the quantum state. So for him, quantum states aren't real. They don't exist in the world. They're a construct, so that we have a placeholder until we measure which one that they are. And I think that's quite possible. And he made an extraordinarily strong case. But that actually wouldn't change a whole lot for social scientists, because it would mean that the world out there is actually quite chancy and quite novel, quite unfinished, until we get involved in it. And that makes a lot of social scientists profoundly uncomfortable.
Mm. Well, of course, that's the one thing he does believe in, that it is probabilistic, that
yes.
In fact it is chancy, and there's a lot of excitement because it's unfinished business.
Right.
So to the question of entanglement and the way you understand it, just explain to me then how you extrapolate that into
right.
the broader world of, for instance, international relations.
Right. For me, I'm much closer to Chris. I don't think it's spooky. I just think that it is profoundly nonlinear and much weirder than we give it credit for. So for instance, if I'm interested in the entanglement between ISIS as an organization and this event, the shooting that took place in San Bernardino, a traditional, you know, social scientist or security studies person is going to try to find an intelligence relationship. So X shooter got a payoff from Y organization, which relates to Z bank, which we can then track back to ISIS. Now, that would be great. But in fact, what we know about San Bernardino now is that it had no relationship to ISIS. Now, we've said that, and the FBI has made announcements to that effect. But people are still quite convinced that San Bernardino was an ISIS attack, right? They feel the attack of ISIS, which suggests that there's a kind of relationship between American voters and occupants of San Bernardino and this event over in Syria called ISIS, which doesn't scale at the properties of traditional relationships. But the problem is that if communication works the way that we think in the classical sense, then putting the new information ought to displace it, and it doesn't. Finding out that this wasn't part of a grand conspiracy, there was no sleeper cell in San Bernardino, doesn't take away the feeling that there was a sleeper cell. And I think the reverse version is true for climate change, particularly in the United States. It doesn't matter how much data the IPCC piles on, which ought to create this understanding that there's a world and it's warming up, but there doesn't seem to be any direct correlation between the amount of truth that can be demonstrated in an empirical sense and the feeling that it's true in a kind of affective or embodied sense. And for me, that's the, like in physics, they talk about hard problems, right? These problems, and consciousness study talks about hard problems. They're things that sort of continuously plague the field. Social science is a field that tries to study rational actors and causal relationships. And yet we're filled with people who are rational some of the time, but at the end of the day, feeling beings. And we don't have a particularly good way of understanding or studying the relationships of feeling that, again, are often also quite non-spatial, right?
So taking it back to the San Bernardino shooters, where does entanglement come in there? Because I think what you're saying to me there is that, in fact, there isn't a causal relationship, or there is not one. There isn't one that we can actually point to.
There's not an empirical relationship.
Only an empirical relationship. But
And this is actually, this is part of what I'm trying to develop as a quantum social theory, which is that all things are material, right? I don't believe in a world of the mind as being separate from the world of bodies and reality. But not everything, in some sense, is physical. Meaning that there can be these vast relationships between the events of ISIS or the idea of ISIS and actually quite large collectivities that are thousands of miles away from it that are affected, that become connected. And so in some sense, because of the way that ISIS has changed the collective mood of the United States, an event like San Bernardino can't take place without immediately feeling connected to Syria. And I think that's a strange kind of causality. That, for instance, ISIS will benefit from the events that happened in San Bernardino. It's as if they attacked the United States. And one of the ways that we know that is that Trump's numbers were starting to flag before San Bernardino. He was finally starting to lose momentum and even turn around a bit. And he made up 13 points in about 3 weeks after the attacks. What is that? Well, it's not evidence, because he didn't have some new pile of evidence. And it's not exactly unreason either. People really feel scared. The mental states, right, the brain states are real, but their relationship, their causal relationship to Syria is quite specious. That doesn't mean that we can't study them.
So where does the probabilistic aspect fit in with that?
In the way that I think threat functions. So threat is a very interesting phenomenon. So the Director of Homeland Security in the United States recently announced that ISIS will attack the mainland within a year. Now, we understand that as a statistical assessment, that some amount of study has said ISIS, you know, given their capabilities and their interests, will physically hit the United States within the year. The reality is that future possibility has already taken place emotionally. By announcing it, now everyone's scared, which is the effect of terrorism, right? The thing that you want to do when you do terrorism is not gain a military advantage because you're very small. It's to alter the kind of emotional space of your opponent. So the very announcing of the threat, which started statistically or probabilistically, once said out loud and in public and through the vast network of media, became real, even if it's not actual in the sense of the event having taken place. And so we tend to think about the analysis of threat or the discussion of threat as if it were probabilistic, but it actually ceased being probabilistic once it was announced, right? It ceased being merely a statistical possibility because the announcement itself was an event. And trying to disentangle what that means and what that does is actually quite difficult, particularly in security studies. Mm. Affective fallout doesn't measure in time and space very well. It's French philosopher Henri Bergson. So there's two kinds of sort of characteristics in the world. They're extensive relations, which are things like how many inches something is, how much something weighs. And then there are what he called intensive magnitudes, how angry you are, how afraid you are. And the problem of an intensive magnitude is it's not an extension. It's not in space and time. You can't measure how afraid you are or how much you feel related to this phenomena going on in Syria. But for him, that doesn't mean it's not real. And that's a hard idea for social scientists to wrap their head around, that that's not some kind of mysticism to say that there is a real thing that isn't physical, right? There's a real thing that we can't measure, or at least we can't measure it in the sort of traditional sense of observation and, you know, dicing it up into something like inches. We can't have an affective measure.
Jiris Grove on the philosophical implications of what he calls the quantum conversation, using the insights of contemporary physics to make sense of the wider world beyond elemental particles, from art to the fraught world of international politics. He's our guest today on the Philosopher's Zone. You say that international relations needs the quantum or a quantum turn. So what would it mean in terms of hard international relations? What does it mean to take the quantum turn?
Well, I mean, at the very base minimum, and I think this is something that the work James Derderian's done on quantum diplomacy and sort of quantum international relations is quite demonstrative of, which is that the event of ubiquitous terminal velocity media coverage and media consumption isn't just a quantitative difference. It's not just more media. I think it actually changes, it hacks our bodies, right? We experience events in a kind of new simultaneity, which makes the old imagined community simultaneity seem quite ridiculous, right? Quite quaint. And that has real effects. That's not just a problem of like public opinion or support. It actually alters what whole countries do, right? The United States has fought now a nearly 15-year war on terrorism, which by any traditional realist international relations measure makes no sense at all. And the other version of that, the sort of traditional, what I'd call Noam Chomsky version, which is that there are elites that benefit from the war on terrorism, and that explains all of it. That's just not true. You know, very good-natured, very liberal people who are progressive see someone now in a hijab, and they tighten up a little bit, even though they don't want to. Which is not to excuse that there's a racism that's involved there, but it means that there's two very different kinds of racism. There's the ideological racism of thinking that this is a clash of civilizations, believing that Western sort of society is superior. And then there's a bodily racism, which has internalized this fear in such a way that it doesn't matter what particular signifier of Islam is present, the body tenses up, it flinches. And that's where I think that kind of intensive relation of affect, that kind of quantum relation has to be understood, because that flinch is not rational. It's not reflective, but it can often prime what kinds of rational and reflective ideas we can have.
So where is, can I just put my finger on, where is the quantum button in that? So you've discussed there how people will interpret the hijab or interpret various symbols of the terror, the war on terror that we have on at present. Where is the quantum understanding in that?
I think it's in the interval between that affective bodily reaction and the actually quite slower temporal pace of consciousness, right? There are, in some sense, two different humans in every body, right? I'm not going to, metaphorically, we could say it's like a wave-particle duality. I don't think it's an actual wave-particle duality. I'm not quite sold on the idea that we have quantum consciousness. But we definitely have two very different kind of momentums of human cognition and sensuous experience. And one is very reactive and reptilian and overdetermining and happens very quickly. And one is often not conscious of that reptilian character and moves quite slowly. And I think they feed back into one another, but they actually work by very different orders. So the same way that you can have classical physics working just above quantum mechanics, I think you can have rationality working just above the sort of affect of emotion and response. But if we're not attending to both of them, then it shouldn't surprise us that one more pronouncement from the IPCC on how much better our ice core sampling data is doesn't actually change how convinced people are that climate change is happening.
That's an interesting one, because as you say, that's in reverse to some of the other ones you've discussed. But if I could just take you back to this, that two-step process of affect to rational deliberation, that is kind of like the two-step moral process, isn't it? First something hits you, then you stop and say, hang on, I've got to think about this, and you make a judgment after that.
I think the problem, though, is the two-step moral process, like kind of Kantian transcendental subjectivity, tends to imagine this fully formed human that gets to sit over the process and be like, oh, wait, didn't that just happen? But the reality is it's co-constitutive, right? So often what you can and can't reflect on is primed by how one's body reflects. Not in its entirety. We're not entirely mechanical or determined, but it gets a head start. And so I think it actually takes something quite more than deliberation to attend to that. Right? You really have to think about how one becomes a self, right? How one calms oneself down, how one deals with anxiety, where anxiety is coming from. And that actually isn't like deliberation at all. It's experimenting on oneself to figure out, well, maybe I shouldn't set my phone to update me every time there's a bombing in Lebanon. Sure, I study Lebanon, but maybe I don't need that ding on my iPhone at 2 o'clock in the morning. Not because I don't want to know that, but actually the ding, the actual tension that it causes to have my phone vibrate every 2 or 3 minutes may make it harder for me to study that as an event, right? Because all I can do is feel it, right? It overdetermines what I can study. And so I think that's it's a modified two-step process.
It's a bit of a problem, because to escape the ding economy right now is almost impossible, isn't it?
Right, because it seems like you're getting behind. And I think that's part of what I would like to say is that we think the ding economy is in some sense adding depth to our knowledge. But if the ding economy is having a kind of anxiety fallout, then it may be thinning out the knowledge we have, right? And that awareness, mere awareness, may be quite contradictory to having depth of knowledge.
Just finally, Jaris, your understanding of this, you've actually discussed this with quantum physicists, whose model primarily belongs to. What do they make of you importing or exporting that model to a larger
They quite like that I don't want to import quantum ideas. That what I'd like to do is say, look what physics had to go through to live in some sense, two worlds at the same time. Now, what would the correlate or the analog be in social science? I think they're quite tired of people saying, we can just take entanglement. Nothing makes a quantum physicist sigh more than someone says, love. When once two souls are entangled, even at great distances, they feel longing, right? You know, that kind of metaphoric application makes them quite irritated. I think Chris in particular was happy that what I was trying to do is something quite different, which is to say that there are these relations in social sciences which are real, but don't involve physics at all. But they're weird, right? So they require the kind of conceptual breakthroughs that quantum physicists had to do to understand how a quantum and classical world coexist. And so, you know, maybe he was just being flattering, but this time around, he didn't seem irritated. Now, the quantum engineers are a little bit different. You know, a number of the quantum physicists that we're working with are actually, they're trying to apply quantum physics to make something like quantum computing work, to make it commercially available, or at least nationally available. And this idea that there's something they can't measure, that better computers running faster, being able to process more variables, couldn't make sense of, I don't think they like that idea. A quantum computer is supposed to be able to finally create the world in a bottle. And so if some of the world is only intensive and not extensive, then they haven't bottled it yet. And that, I think, we may never quite meet on. But it's an old philosophical fight. But it's one that we thought was a world between matter and ideas. And I don't think that that's actually true. I think intensive relationships exist in the material world, but they're not physical. And so that means that they might not slice in a way that works through digital or even qubit computation.
To work out what they really are is another story altogether, and we probably don't have the time today to do it. Thank you for being in the Philosopher's Zone. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much.
Leaping Leptons, Jaris Grove of the University of Hawaii, stretching the quantum model all the way to global politics. His keynote address at the Q Symposium this year was titled Terrorism in the Age of Quantum Insecurity. Details on our site. Jaris Grove has been a guest of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Korea and the Japanese Ministry of Science and Technology, among other postings, and is currently working with indigenous and island communities facing the challenge of sea level rise. And a final note before we go. Umberto Eco died last week, aged 84. He always thought of himself as a philosopher first, but his literary work propelled his name. Check out a link on our site to a great discussion on Eco and his work, broadcast on Books and Arts Daily in 2014. Some great insights. Thanks this week to Diane Dean and Michelle Watts. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you again on The Philosopher's Zone.